You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today's date is the 23rd of September, 2023. That's when it's being recorded. I don't know when it's going to air exactly. As always, I thank my donors. You guys have brought me through some extremely difficult periods of time. And like I always say, don't forget Sven Longshanks. On Radio Albion and Patriotic Alternative, there's a bunch of places where you can learn how to get in touch with them. I just sent another letter and some money just yesterday. Now, I want to talk about something, actually, or someone that I have spoken of maybe a year ago, maybe a little bit more. It was one of my favorite Russian saints, Saint Ignaty Bonchaninov, who died in 1867. Whenever I did part one of that, I focused mostly on the political side of things, like Russian bishops of that age, at least at the time. He was a royalist, convinced that Russia had a world historical plan in God's eyes to fulfill. Now, of course, when the monarchy fell, the February Revolution, many bishops fell away too, rejoicing in the fall of the monarchy. But at least now, you know, he died in 1867. He's in a very optimistic time in Russia, or Alexander II. And today I'm going to be talking about The Arena. I bought this book. It's published by St. Job Potiev, which is the publishing house of the Jordanville Seminary, Holy Trinity. I bought this a million years ago, and I've been through it many times. By far, at least in English, it's his best known work. It's formally addressed to younger monastics, people who at least are called to the monastic life and are given a blueprint, so to speak, as to what that life consists. But like all, I mean, it's not a rule, but it certainly is a psychological deep dive into the mentality that a monk is supposed to have in order to truly be one. And it's divided up into short chapters on a specific topic. And they're, you know, and I'm going to deal with these not in any particular order, but as they occur to me, they're interesting. And he isn't discussed in the West nearly as much as he should be. Unlike St. Seraphim of Sarov, for example, not only was he a holy man, but he was an excellent writer. And, you know, he was prescient in things that he couldn't possibly have known at the time. Because for us, you know, he says that he is a bishop in a time of decay and apostasy. 1860s, 1850s. My God, that's utopia for us, by comparison, with what we have to suffer with every single day. But he's well aware of what's coming. Obviously, a title like The Arena, he's referring to the gladiatorial combat And it isn't so much that you as an individual are taking on the world and the various definitions of that word, or demons, or evil people. That's a sure way to total destruction. Even in, you know, exorcisms. The minute you even hint that you are casting out a demon on your own authority, you're going to lose. And you're going to lose often violently. But it's as a member of the church, it's as a part of something that not only has a channel to grace or energy, but in fact is that grace and energy. There is a singular concept of God's energy and grace that exists. That's the remaking of Eden, and therefore a foretaste of heaven. And for those in the church, the only thing that keeps us from it is our own sins and our own attachment to the world around us, which today it's almost inconceivable that we can get around this. He wrote in an age where mass media really was in its infancy. He did not conceive of something like the internet and how easy it is for media to be recorded and distributed. All the images that we see creates fantasies. Those fantasies over time are taken as realities. Demons can't create. Creating illusions and dreams and fantasies, that's as close as they can come. Which is why the concept, you picture yourself with a lot of money or with a particular woman. And it, you know, it's a dopamine now, a rush. And sometimes you get so involved that you forget yourself. And you end up following this with a fanatical singularity of mind. And a best case scenario, is that you achieve it and you realize that it's not worth having. For a whole bunch of reasons, stuff you never really thought of before. Because what you were going on is your fantasy. And fantasies tend not to have a whole lot of flaws in them. Everything is coming from your own mind. Now, he also, when I say that he recognizes what's coming, he doesn't say that he's living in the end times. Clearly, there were leftist groups out there that were trying to kill the emperor, and of course, succeeded in a few cases. So he knows that these ideologies want to see a Republican divided secular Russia, as the Februarists brought about. Now, for us, of course, the fall of the Roman Empire, which was in the person of Tsar Nicholas II, carrying all of that within itself, that's the beginning of the end. Because now there is no Roman Emperor, and therefore there is no restrainer. St. Ignatius understands this only indirectly, because it is very difficult for people to conceive of the state without a monarch. And that's why it became such a major part of his work. And I cited a whole bunch of smaller works of his the last time we spoke about him. But in the beginning of this book, he makes it very clear that as unhealthy as monasticism had become, the world is just getting started on it. You know, principles like you know, various far-left Bolshevist-style organizations were fairly well-known in Russia at the time. Terrorism towards that end was well-known. And therefore, he realizes that in the future, it's going to be infinitely worse than what we're suffering now. Because in the 1850s, 1860s, he sees that there's this massive multiplication of temptations that didn't exist decades or centuries prior. Technology has made pursuing these fantasies very easy. and gives some illusion that you can fulfill it. St. Ignatius says, when the true end times are present, there will be no monasticism. The first generation of monastics were, in his mind, perfect, that is to say, in need of nothing. That was the height of the Christian life, and ever since then, it's been a long, slow degeneration. He cites St. Pliny the Great and many other Egyptian ascetics of the ancient world, saying that there will be a day when future generations will do maybe half as well as we do, and on and on and on. And when Antichrist is here, there'll be no monasticism whatsoever. He realizes that he wasn't in that state at the time. But he did see, and a handful of others at the time, saw, I want to say the writing on the wall, which of course is a literal issue with the murder of Tsar Nicholas, but he saw an outline, the coming regime, the constant hostility of London against Russia, was the headquarters of the regime at the time. But those of us who are stuck in these end times, I know St. Paisi says something very similar, those who are left, those of us, we are saved, if not by your typical ascetic labors, which he seemed to think would be impossible at this age, we are saved through suffering. And in fact, salvation through suffering, the patient endurance of suffering, is one of the core themes of this book. We are being sinned against as much as actually doing the sinning. We're in a position that no other generation could have even begun to understand except through the infusion of grace. It's extremely difficult. I mean, you step onto an American university, what life is like there, or the internet, anything else. What would the fathers have said about that? And you know, St. Ignatius gives us a hint saying that monasticism just can't happen. We will be persecuted and assaulted, and that's going to be enough so long as we recognize that the will of God is present there. Cutting off your own will to accept the will of God is to patiently endure these evils, especially, you know, in our little world. You know, the church as a whole, the state, whatever, is a different story. But as individuals, there's not going to be enough people to put up a powerful front against Antichrist. Sufferings are always, according to St. Ignatius, good things. In fact, if salvation is based on how we handle suffering, and suffering is a tiny little taste of what hell might be like, then suffering is only bad when we're in the midst of it. It's easy to talk about suffering when you're not actually suffering at the moment, but it builds Christian people. If your typical monastic life isn't going to exist in the last days, the persecution will have to suffice. Now, I know there's other saints, many of you may be considering it now, where those that endure the end times, they will actually have the greater victory than in the much more rational earlier generations of the church, because we're putting up with things. And many of us are raised with it long before any of us converted, and has helped form our brain. You know, this is a very plastic organ. And so many of these assumptions, priorities, we were raised with long before we had any conception of resisting it. By the time many of us convert, you know, we've been brainwashed, and it's a lot of work to break out of it, at least intellectually, at least in the noumenal world, in the world of the spirit. There are two things, we'll get more details on this as time goes on. Faith, meaning the church, and confession. The sacrament of confession is stressed, at least in a few places, in the arena. Part of the reason is because we can do nothing without a strong spiritual guide. Now, in going over this stuff, I am not claiming to be an ascetic. I'm not claiming to be a theologian in the true sense of the word. I'm a historian, and that's how I'm approaching this, especially a historian of ideas. But this can be approached profitably only if we, in his words, guard the stomach. And he means that metaphorically as well as literally. Indulging in food is a way to soften, and of course drink, meaning wine and things like that. Once you're surrounded with luxury, it affects you. Great poverty is an evil, but so are great riches. St. Paisius says that it's this lack of belief in any alternatives, this tranquility, he says, and he doesn't mean literally that, but that people think that this is all there is, and there's no way to talk to them about it. Temperance of the stomach is no different than what you may see on a screen, what you may fantasize in your mind. You're letting garbage into your system, and this is before anything like, you know, these food processing entities that are poisoning people today. We don't eat food, we eat food-like products, and it's getting much worse. So just like we want to avoid looking at certain things, or fantasizing, or even thinking about certain things, same thing goes for overeating and drinking. The ascetic life for St. Ignatius is very similar. He uses an agricultural metaphor. Even that itself, I mean, most people are separated from now. Of course, at the time, that was nowhere near the case. But what do you have to do before, not even when you harvest, but when you plant? What do you have to do? Well, you have to get yourself settled on a piece of land. Then you have to go and turn over the fields. You have to get rid of the rocks. You have to get rid of the weeds. Anything that's going to get in the way of sowing. So this is before you even plant. Of course, the seed is, you know, as you see in the New Testament, is the Word of God. But this was long before you even conceive of harvest or even watching it grow. The ascetic life is that first step, and it's extremely hard work where you have to clear the field of everything that really doesn't belong there, rocks and roots and you have to, you know, trees and everything like that, to make it suitable for farming. And that's what this is what the Protestants never quite understood. Because Protestantism has, you know, lost any concept of sin in their, you know, they don't have confession, they don't have any asceticism, they certainly don't have any penance. Their conception of sin is so anemic as to be non-existent, which is why, without a culture of their own, they fit into whatever culture is around them. In fact, if anything, in America, they've adopted the Judaic culture as their own. I know in a few Protestant seminaries, you have to go to a Seder meal. And these people think that they're being cultured because of it, having no idea that right down the street, you have the fulfillment of that in the liturgy. No, they don't do that. But the acceptance of the power structure, wherever they are, is one of the central sins of Protestantism. But just like indifferentism and apostasy are great evils, so is the opposite. In fact, St. Ignatius has a whole conception of balance in the spiritual life. Stressing one side over everything else is destructive. And actually, this is one of his attacks on the old belief. And he oversimplifies it by saying they take the liturgical issues and blow them so out of proportion that it's the only thing that's on their mind. There's some people who hate ecumenism to the point where that's really the only concern they have. And because of that, other sins are getting past you because you're so focused on this one one problem. It is a legitimate problem. Now, of course, St. Ignatius oversimplifies the nature of the old believer rebellion, but I understand the point he's making. You can't stress the sacramental life at the expense of your own personal prayer life. The two have to go together. Sacraments aren't magic spells. They simply make it easier for us to approach God's energy or grace. It is an integral part of the ascetic life. So to use a postmodern metaphor, it doesn't work, quote unquote, unless you have the right frame of mind. You've done the clearing of the field beforehand. He talks about confession in a few places, but confession is the institutionalization of the relationship between spiritual father and spiritual son. The prayer of absolution is not a spell. It doesn't, wipe the slate clean. It's implied that you're approaching this with sorrow, recognizing your sins, and putting practices in place so you may not fall into the same sins again. And everything else, all of the things have to be equal there. But because St. Ignatius, especially for young men, do not trust yourself because the world is still very fresh in you. And the biggest problem, one of the reasons I think he says that monasticism at the end times is going to be impossible is it isn't so much just a matter of getting away from the cities, getting away from civilization, as he says. We bring civilization with us internally, and it acts as a filter and alters our perception. So in this vein, he's talking about zeal that leads to condemnation. There's a self-righteousness, and we've all met people like this. They're anti-ecumenical, and so they avoid certain churches. But it's not necessarily because of that. It's because these churches are not worthy of them. And that's a very fine line. It's very difficult to, for the individual, judging in your own case, to tell where he is on that spectrum. Do you believe that you're a part of this, true Orthodox or whatever group we're talking about because of you? Because God has chosen you out of all these awful sinners out there. I think it's more common than we want to admit. I think all of us have fallen into this sin at one time or another. And that's why confession is so important. Because you're saying this to an experienced elder. And over the centuries, these elders have become almost clairvoyant because they have heard so many of the same problems repeating and the same patterns. The extraneous detail of the sins is far less important than the patterns concerning the human psyche that are found in them. We're all sinners, and it's okay to hate yourself for that, but it isn't okay to condemn everyone else. Now, it isn't so cut and dry, but the line between not wanting to, an old believer saying, I'm chosen to be, the herald of the counter-revolution. And, I'm worthy of that. I belong here. Versus, on the other side, self-condemnation. Putting up with what you need to put up with in a certain circumstance. Knowing full well it's tremendously imperfect, and that's going to get worse and worse as the years go on. A sign of healing, though, and he's far from alone in this regard, but a sign of healing is when your own sins loom larger and larger. The biggest problem is that we're judges in our own case. We are inherently biased. One thing that the ascetic life and confession does, grace itself, is allow us to see ourselves objectively. And that's extremely difficult to do. We're very quick to make excuses. And when you have kind of grown out of that, and you see what you're capable of, and you see that objectively, that's a sign of grace. The multiplication of justifications, rationalizations, and excuses is a sign of the opposite. It's a sign of failure. Nothing here is getting better. This is getting worse. It can only get better from the point of view of our small institutions, our small churches and families. There is progress that can be possible. In fact, the progress could be very great because of the age we're living in. But we live in an age where the regime uses the insights of psychology to change the very nature of our cognition. The redefinition of words, the emotional impact that's manipulated in us from media. What we're expected to want versus what we should want. And the nonstop lies, these images that aren't really there. People who are boasting about themselves, but if you can get inside their head, they don't have any of it. Or if they do, they don't deserve it. And even if they deserve it, it's not as good as I thought. And you dedicate your life to the pursuit of money, and when you get it, you realize it's nothing but a headache. You start wondering, maybe the other way was better. But because it takes so much work to get there, you have the very high opportunity cost of neglecting the spirit. But this is also what the Fathers and St. Ignatius means by weeping. I was perplexed when I first read about tears. It doesn't necessarily have to be physical tears, salt water coming out of your eyes. No, it's our state of mind when we recognize the enormity of our sins, especially relative to the benefits that we have. So when you're very angry at somebody, especially if it's someone you love, and you lay into them, at the time, it feels good. But then once you calm down, you should be inconsolable, I should say, because you're not in that state anymore. Oh my God, I insulted this person. I said horrible things. Half of them I didn't even mean. I wanted to hurt him that bad. But when that passion, that impetus is gone, you feel like a fool. The more acute that feeling, the better off you are. In other words, tears, which is a part of the hesychastic mind, come from the same source, or recognizing the enormity of your sin and being able to look at yourself objectively. So it's no accident that St. Ignatius says, whenever you're going up against any of your passions, realize that there's not a whole lot you as an individual can do. If you believe that you're going to stop your temper or something like that, and you get to do this, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z, this is what I'm going to do when it comes up, you're going to fail. You aren't necessarily in charge of this. The state of acceptance, objectivity, and discernment, that's a different story. It's precisely in admitting that there's nothing I can do here. If this were just the natural world and there was no world of grace, I would have no chance. I would just become an automaton at this point, programmed to sin. But of course, we don't live that way. In the world, there's no such thing as absolute evil or absolute good. Even the church is not just in the world. There's a heavenly component to it. And freedom can be found in that ambiguity. And this is, again, one of the reasons why it's really tough to talk about committing sins, because there's so many circumstances and there's so many problems, especially in how we were raised and what we're surrounded by. Trying to figure out what's consent and what's determinant is extremely difficult. But that's not really the point. We have one option. And that is to patiently endure with the understanding that as individuals, there's nothing we can do. I've used the example of the phenomenon in the noumenal world, where in the noumenal world, the world of our intellect, we can have a perfect faith, understanding the truths of the church in a human way. The minute that gets put out into the world through action, the will, when the will is involved, it's a completely different story. You know, on paper, we can have the knowledge necessary for it that any Christian is supposed to have and have it all be true. But the minute I step out of my room, that all falls apart. And how quickly we forget about all that when we're faced with temptation. The regime as it stands now holds out great wealth and sexuality that comes from it, calls this success, calls this power, and hence everyone else is a loser. And this is where our effort and time should go, because there's nothing practical, as they may say. You don't really get anything out of the liturgy or whatever. That's has nothing to do with the day-to-day world. It's not real. Truth of the matter is, the overwhelming majority of men are going to fail at that. The only way to win is not to play. And the way to not play is to say that these aren't ends worth striving for at all. St. John Chrysostom spends a lot of time talking about this. Those who, let's say you picture someone who has been successful in that definition of the term and has high prestige and makes big money and has women everywhere and has a nice car and all this, and you feel a tinge of jealousy for this person, even anger. But that's only seen from your point of view. From their point of view, they're not as secure as they would like you to be. It's the old slogan, you know, you can't judge your own day-to-day versus someone else's highlight reel, versus something that they allow you to see. You have no idea what goes on behind the scenes. All it takes is one economic downturn, one bad lawsuit, one accusation of sexual impropriety, an accusation, God forbid, of racism, and everything you have can be taken away. Can be taken away very quickly. Can you imagine if you put all your eggs in that basket, you reach the pinnacle of what you think success is, and then you're cast down because of one stupid move. You do one thing, you're falsely accused, and your reputation is destroyed. Therefore, that can't be the end that we have to pursue. And in fact, failure, according to St. Ignatius, is when God says, if you reach this goal, you're going to be destroyed spiritually. It isn't what you think it is. So you fail. God puts roadblocks in your way until you stop trying. There's a reason why you fail. It's not because you're stupid or a loser or anything else. Very few people can succeed in that definition of the term. It's because God recognizes the fact that if you were to become like that, you would be a million times worse off. You would never know another day's peace. Men fantasize about beautiful women 24 hours a day. But let's just say a tiny percentage who actually get one, they never sleep another night. They know every guy's hitting on her out there. She could be doing anything if I'm not with her. You will never know another day of peace if you actually succeed. And you could end up driving yourself crazy and, of course, eventually losing her. But in your fantasy, that doesn't come up. Everything in the fantasy is great, but that's because it's a fantasy. Don't underestimate the power of those images in getting people to do things. That is, in fact, the delusion that creates the postmodern mentality. A life of luxury, or putting it differently, the life of getting everything that you want leads itself to destruction. Suffering is essential for salvation. For those who don't have to suffer, and there's plenty of people like that, end up being very immature. Luxury and getting what you want takes your attention away from actual real life, from privation. You don't have to call on God if you don't have a whole lot of problems, if you get everything you set out to get. You end up being very full of yourself. I have what I have because I deserve it, no matter how objectively false that statement might be. I've earned it. You know, it's very rare that they could actually say that. Much of it has been given. St. Basil, and it's one of my favorite quotes from St. Basil, says that for those who have been allowed to reach the pinnacle of that success, that means, and in fact it's a sure sign, that God has abandoned them. There's a reason why you're not allowed to reach that level of success, and the reason is because the minute you would get it, you would be cast down. That would be your sole occupation. It will take you away from everything that concerning the spirit and concerning the faith. You won't have time, and pretty soon you won't have the inclination because you have everything you need. Because sufferings are not bad things. You know, the modern world is this one lengthy drive to avoid pain. Well, we don't have a doctrine of purgatory, and for a very good reason, because we're living in it. It's neither hot nor cold. It's neither good nor bad. It's a realm where freedom actually can matter, because there is no strict determination of any object or state of affairs. Money can be good, money can be bad. A beautiful woman could be good, could be bad, mostly bad. This is where freedom comes from. But because sufferings and privations aren't bad, they do come from God. We proceed on this path, the ascetic life. God has then arranged everything. So we will suffer. We will get angry at ourselves, everybody else. We will lose our temper. We will get very frustrated because we're surrounded by people who seem to be doing much better, whether it be, you know, financially or professionally. But as St. Ignatius says over and over again, the world is a liar and the world's a deceiver. And as I've said 100 times before, it's because the world functions via fantasy, images, not just the images on your screen, which are, you know, staged in every possible way they can be staged. It doesn't exist in reality, but in your own mind as well. Media is a transmission belt in this regard, especially entertainment media. We don't have a life of a sitcom character because there is no such thing. You're seeing a tiny snippet of someone's life, highly arranged and highly stylized. No one actually lives that way. How many times you come across, speaking of entertainment, you come across someone who becomes successful, let's say in acting or music. These people are never happy. It adds just extra layers of anxiety and pain to have to deal with this stuff all the time. Things that you don't think about on your way up. But how does he define the word world? There's a million ways, just in common sense, that we can define it. The world is simply the cosmos. It could be the planet Earth. But that's not how it's used. The world, the flesh, the devil, etc., these are almost synonymous, not only in the patristic era, but in the New Testament. The world is the institutionalization of sin. Sin is no longer an individual act. It's mandated. It becomes a part of your makeup. It's another word for all the passions taken together and their collective impact on everything we touch. That's what the world is. It's everything that isn't from God's energy. Everything that is passionate, everything that is unfree, everything that is based on fantasy. The world is in a state of apostasy. It always is. How many people came out to greet Christ at any given moment, especially near the end? How many people were at by the cross? You could count them on one hand. Even the apostles were too scared to show up. Well, today isn't going to be any different. The people who were singing Hosanna to him on Palm Sunday were the same people that were condemning him a few days later that Friday. The world is a liar, and so are people. We don't want to admit our problems and weaknesses to just anybody. We want to put on a front, and social media, of course, has been diabolical in this respect, that we want people to know. Depression comes in, really despondency, I should say, because you know the gigantic gap between what you put out in public, what you think you're getting across, and what the reality really is. People use the word narcissism a lot. Now, many of you know I don't take psychology all that seriously, or psychiatry. Very different things. But the definition of narcissism, you know, if you're going to use the word properly, it's the idea that you believe that you have a right to greatness. You have some extraordinary ability, whether it be intellect or looks or whatever, and you deserve special treatment because of it. Well, that in and of itself is not narcissism. No, narcissism is the realization that that's not true. You aren't special. You failed far more than you'll ever admit to people, that what you're putting out to the world is an absolute lie. And rather than confront that, all you care about is making sure to surround yourself with people who continuously reinforce that myth that you tell about yourself, self-romanticization, and getting rid of or attacking anybody who points out the fact that it's just not true. Narcissism and personality disorders like that are based on falsity. I mean, if you work really hard, maybe you do deserve a certain reward. And if you don't get it, it's an injustice, and you should be angry. That isn't narcissism. Narcissism is that gap between what you say you are and what you really are. The sociopath is better off because the sociopath doesn't care about things like that. Good, evil, right, wrong, they're all the same to them. There's no conscience whatsoever. The narcissist isn't like that. The narcissist realizes that they're not who they say they are, and they live in dread and fear of being exposed by somebody. And it's very obvious how that applies to the situation we're talking about here. The world is a liar. These fantasies are always being fed, no matter what we do. Because even if we were to go to the wilderness and live as monastics, first of all, how many of us can do that? How many of us have the skills? You know, when St. Ignatius wrote, you didn't have the electricity grids or water grids. You had your beginnings of it in the cities. But the average person could pack up and go and live in the woods. They don't need sewer hookups or anything else. Your whole life is on the phone. That creates a web of dependency that makes it not worth it. No one ever voted for that. That's imposed on us. And even things like spiritual peace and calm can be based on an illusion. It could be based on your own ego. It could be based on your own self-will. You start believing your own press. It depends on the basis. Whatever you're feeling, what is it based on? Is it based on me not thinking I'm getting what I deserve? And do I really deserve it? Or am I lying to myself? This is why the spiritual father is so important. Because this is exactly what you ask him. And a good spiritual father is going to be deadly honest. No, you are falling into that, you know, that personality disorder, that narcissistic trend that almost defines postmodernity. This false pride in nothing. This self-assertion. He notes that even under the best of circumstances, you have these sudden, very intrusive thoughts. And he said that is the presence, especially when there's no obvious cause for it. that is a presence of a sinful spirit, of a demonic spirit. One of the ways that you can determine this is how you feel. Are you filled with confusion, self-contradiction, and dread? When you're considering something, when you're thinking of something, is it ambiguous? That's a sign that it comes from the demonic powers. That is not how a godly thought acts. So when you have a very intrusive thought from out of nowhere, you are being directly attacked. Demonic thought is always based on confusion and ambiguity. Now again, if you're a sociopath, none of this works. Because you have no conception of any of that. Everything is, if it serves your interest, it doesn't matter what it is. But we're not talking about that. And none of these can be confronted alone. Our job is to endure this stuff with humility, knowing full well that we're going to fail, unless, of course, the church come and help us. Failures and sufferings create humility. We take absolutely nothing for granted. God alone can defeat these things. It's a matter of accessing grace rather than forcing yourself upon it. One of the things that typifies our world is precisely that there's nothing absolutely good or nothing absolutely bad. But that has absolutely nothing to do with recognizing the nature of a fantasy. Recognizing it for exactly what it is. St. Pulman the Great of Egypt is something that someone that St. Ignatius quotes a few times. He defines the faith as showing mercy and humility. Those are the two elements of the faith according to the Egyptian desert. When St. Anthony the Great was confronted by demons, you know, roughly around the same time, he could laugh at them. They took the form of monsters and, you know, whether they're figments of imagination, doesn't matter. They're not of his making. The only way that he was able to tolerate them, and even to the point where he can laugh at them, is by recognizing that he's powerless against them. But we are members of the church. That's how you have to approach everything. God will not permit you anything else if you have the proper will and proper disposition. Talking about God's will can be a problem. St. Ignatius and really all the fathers of any era say that cutting off your own will and meekly obeying the will of God is essential to salvation. But what exactly does that mean? It seems to suggest that we accept whatever befalls us and don't attempt to change anything. But that's exactly what the ascetic life is. It's about getting better. Monastery is a spiritual hospital. We're all sick. You expect tons of sin for people who have the objectivity to enter into a monastery. No, that answer is coming from the wrong point of view. It's coming from the wrong starting place. God's will can be discerned if and only if we have learned to reject the world. The nonstop war on the passions and sin through grace, and of course our own personal knowledge of the truth, is how God's will can be discerned. If it conforms with one of the axioms of the postmodern world, it isn't from God. And in fact, that's how we go about analyzing anything. God's will is deducible when you remove self-interest, the heteronomous elements of anything. When you reject the world, God's will is discernible. Of course, that's a big if. When you sin, you're not just manifesting the fall within you. The fall of all mankind is found in this. Questions of consent to sin and sinning freely versus sinning. There's so many gradients there that it really is a stupid discussion. Now, a lot of Roman Catholics have this problem. There's so much complexity here. Understand that sin is a mark of the phenomenal world. Now, it's infinitely worse now than it was 1,000 years ago. But any act you commit is self-regarding. Anything you do is self-regarding. Even the ascetic life. You can say, well, all you care about is your own salvation. This all seems to be centered on you. The phenomenal world is sinful. It's how you test the spirits. Does it conform with doctrine? Does it conform with the world? It's just a matter of self-interest. The judgment, both the particular and the general judgment, is based on your conscience. What have you been covering up? What have you been lying to yourself about? The judgment, it is completely laid bare. There's no hiding anymore. But no matter what happens, the last thing you should do is fall into despair. Despair is a bit more than depression. Despair is a general abulia. Despair is not just that you failed, that you're mired in sin, but that really there's no hope. And maybe you may secretly say to yourself, I'm not worth it anyway. There is a legitimate self-pride that says, yes, I am worth it, not because of my own merits, because God has decreed that I be a member of the church. And according to St. Ignatius, the antidote to that is recognizing that everything that happens in the phenomenal world is permitted or even just simply brought about by the will of God. You know, why were you born in the year you were? What the heck did we do to deserve being forced to live under this regime? God knows what's going to happen to us. Well, when you realize that God has arranged everything for our benefit, a lot of the anxiety goes away. Anxiety is based on this illusion that we can control what happens to us. Most of the time, we are reactive. The passion is something that works on you. You don't work on it. Passion, passive, patient. These all have the same root. Because God rules the destiny of the world, and of course, everything is going to come out right in the end, playing our whatever our small part is the only thing we have to worry about, no matter what happens along the way. God takes care of his people. If you are on the path and you are struggling, now St. Ignatius goes so far as to say you will never be tested against your strength. Now, he's not testing in the literal sense. But how much negativity, how much suffering can I handle before I break? Well, the idea of a break is something that's introduced from the outside. It comes from demons saying that, what have you done to deserve all of this? Why are you suffering like this? You haven't done anything, which of course is a lie. But when you're angry, when you're passionate about something, that mentality is very easy to fall into. So what knocks us off that path? Well, St. Ignatius quotes Isaac the Syrian. Roman Catholics, which is actually a concept adopted by St. Ignatius, of occasions for sin. It's right in the newer Roman Catholic act of contrition. An occasion for sin isn't itself a sin, but it just is very easy to go from there to actual sin in the phenomenal world. And the list of these things, what pulls you off the path, is short. Of course, the first thing St. Isaac says is women. I want to talk about an irresistible, for a normal guy, and talk about just irresistibility. A woman can leave a mark on you mentally that you will never get over. And of course, you're powerless against it. The second is alcohol. Because it lowers your inhibitions, you care much less. really drugs in general. You know, narcotics, narco is the Greek for sleep. Not necessarily literally, but figuratively too. Strangely enough, the next two are health and wealth. If you're healthy for a long period of time, you start seeing yourself as invincible. Death seems so far away when you're healthy. That's not the case when you're ill. Illness, according to St. Ignatius, is a gift. Because now you don't have any capacity to sin. And wealth, I think, is obvious. You can't just sit back and enjoy wealth that you may have. It doesn't work that way. You have to be on top of it 24 hours a day. You could be being ripped off right and left for all you know. Interestingly, he says excessive power. You're in a position of ownership. You've collected these areas of authority. You're the boss. After a while, you're not going to take orders from anybody. The good citizen, according to Aristotle, is somebody who not just can rule, but can also be ruled in turn. A man who could do that is someone who may be an actual legitimate politician, rather than the negative view associated with. Too much power leads us to self-conceit. Well, it should lead us to really, as Marcus Aurelius, who wasn't Christian, the crushing burden that power has. Anyone who would voluntarily seek it out is a problem. Well, liberal democracy is based on people seeking power and gaining it by any means that they can get away with. And finally, the existence of fame or the desire for fame. For a good reputation. What you try to do with all the fake posts on social media. What image that doesn't exist are you trying to put out for everyone to absorb? Well, that's a lie. That's no different than any other lie. It's just, on a very substantial scale. You're putting forth a person that doesn't exist. We mentioned with the narcissist, you know that that doesn't exist. And eventually someone's going to find out. And for all these reasons, St. Ignatius says, we really need to get out of the cities and the suburbs. Monasteries should be in the middle of nowhere. And he says, the closer you get to civilization, the closer you get to fornication. There's a reason why Mount Athos makes it very difficult to get there. While, no women are allowed there. That's all these guys need. It's part of the reason why they live to be 100. They don't have to worry about driving and women. He says that Christ's power is found in his commandments. He has a section on dreams, and it's kind of what sets him apart from a lot of fathers at any era. You have in the New Testament the dream of Joseph to run into Egypt. Well, that may be the exception, and for a very specific reason, dreams are to be ignored. And to a great extent, the same goes for signs. You should probably assume that any sign that you think you get, you're not worthy of. Why does God need to speak to you through dreams and signs when you have thousands of volumes of the canons and the fathers and the New and the Old Testament and spiritual fathers and everything else? You have no control over what happens in your brain while you're dreaming when you're sleeping. That's part of what sleeping is. Therefore, you cannot put any stock. Nothing, there's no messages there. And he says Joseph, St. Joseph is an exception because there it was very clear and very cogent. It was a simple instruction. There was no ambiguity. There was something very specific. Our dreams don't function that way. Dreams are just not that coherent because we're not in charge of them. Ultimately, it's the surrender to the will of God And that is a product of the rejection of the world. But keep in mind that in the phenomenal world, we're going to sin. We're surrounded by it. It is impossible for us to avoid it. And we really don't have power against it. The concept of consent is ephemeral. And you're being sinned against as much as you're sinning. You didn't choose the system that we're forced to live under. Even prayer. I mean, the total concept of the typikon is that there is no such thing as a self-willed prayer. You don't know what you need. The typikon is the saints praying with you. These rules and these particular prayers created thousands of saints, and you're in no position to say otherwise. Rejecting the world is a tremendous step to discerning the will of God. But without humility, none of this works. It's one thing to intellectually have a grasp of it, but the hesychastic idea of the unity of mind and heart is the unity of intellect and will. You can know something is true and still refuse to abide by it. That's because the will and the intellect are two very different faculties. Hesychasm is to reunite them. You know, Adam and Eve had, that was a single unit, intellect and will. The fall separated those two. The intellect is the realm of the noumenal. And the willful is the phenomenal. So sin is a matter of the will. But so is recognizing that we have no power here. That we have long since lost in the natural world. But there is another. And once you realize that God is in charge of everything, God's in charge of your failures and your sufferings, that therefore there's a reason for it. And that should give as much consolation as you're capable of at this point. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.